Welcome to the Naval Academy Museum's Warrior Writers Podcast. I am your host, Sal, from the blog Commander Salamander, and this 14-part series will take you decade by decade, starting with the 1870s, discussing the personalities, technologies, and events that helped shape today's U.S. Navy. This podcast coincides with the Naval Academy Museum's exhibit, Warrior Writers, the U.S. Naval Institute, open from September 10th, 2015, through January 31st, 2016. Our guest for each episode leading us through the decades will be first Naval Academy History Professor Emeritus and noted historian Craig Simons, who is awarded the Samuel Eliot Morison Prize for his novel Neptune, The Allied Invasion of Europe and the D-Day Landing, and is also author of the upcoming book, A Concise History of the U.S. Navy. Craig will be followed by the director of the Naval Academy Museum, Claude Barrabe. Craig, the 1980s were a decade dominated by the Reagan presidency and his determination to make our Navy bigger and better than ever. How successful was he?
Well, he was quite successful, actually. If not in the literal fulfillment of his stated goal of building a 600-ship Navy, he was obviously successful in his broader goal of making a kind of international statement about American maritime leadership, America's place in the world, America's determination to resume the forefront of the great powers of the earth. That business of building up the Navy to 600 ships, it's an arbitrary number. I'm not even sure where it came from. The idea was to make it bigger than it was, and 600 is a nice round number, so we'll shoot for that. He never did quite get to 600, the peak, I think, at the end of the decade in 1989, if you count auxiliaries, support ships, and everything else, you come up with 592, so just short of 600 ships. Now, that's down, obviously, from the peak at the end of World War II, when the United States Navy carried more than 6,000 ships on its roster of vessels, but up from the 530 when he took office. So that's about 160 more ships. I think for Ronald Reagan and his young and vigorous, enthusiastic Navy Secretary John Layman, who kind of honchoed this thing through, it was less the specific capability. In other words, it wasn't that they said, here are things we want to do and we need 600 ships to do those things. It's more like a general statement that the United States is the great power on the earth and the world needs to pay attention. One story in particular that I think helps bring it into focus is his decision, and Layman's decision really, to recommission four of the battleships. The last of those had been decommissioned in 1969 at the end of the Vietnam War, the New Jersey, and Reagan issued orders to reactivate four of them. Now, they were all significantly modified. They had new missile systems and electronic equipment. Each then could perform the role of the centerpiece of a new battle group, so that with the 14 carriers and now four battleships, each at the center of a battle group, that gives us 18 chess pieces to move around on the table. So it was a dramatic statement. People not only domestically but internationally paid attention to that. And I want to make a comparison, if I can, between that ambition and a couple of earlier things we've talked about. You know, Theodore Roosevelt, back when he was the youngest president, as Reagan was the oldest president, Theodore Roosevelt had an ambition very similar to that. It wasn't that he said, we need more battleships in order to achieve a particular military outcome. He said, we need more battleships because we are a great power, and a great power has a great navy. And that was really kind of the philosophy behind the construction of the vessels that became what history calls the Great White Fleet that he sent around the world in 1907 to 1909. And it's kind of in the same mindset that I think Reagan wanted to do this. The problem, and it's a technical and logistical problem as much as anything, was that a battleship is extraordinarily expensive to run. It has an enormous crew. It burns fuel, unprecedented amounts of fuel. And so they were simply not efficient as either gun platforms or even in their new guise as missile platforms. You could get the same bang for the buck, to borrow that tired phrase, on a smaller platform for a lot less money. And so after only a few years, they were all decommissioned, and the Navy, again, dropped down to into the 500s, pretty much where it was when he took office. But the statement had been made. And I want to make one last comment about those battleships, because it's kind of interesting historically that the first United States battleship, the first seagoing battleship, there was the Maine and the Texas in 1886, but the first to be endowed with the BB title, BB-1, was the USS Indiana, and that was launched in 1891. And the last American battleship, the USS Missouri, BB-63, was decommissioned in 1991, so that the era of the battleship lasted for exactly 100 years. And I think Reagan's almost emotional desire to recommission those battleships, to make the Navy visibly great, visibly dominant, was kind of harkened back to that earlier age as well. So it's there's a certain symbolism involved there.
And Craig, that was exactly what I was thinking of when you were describing it, was, you know, TR and the Great White Fleet and what Reagan did in his buildup. And that is an ongoing purpose, and really you could define it as a primary mission area if you wanted to, of a Navy is presence ops. And I know recently we've heard people talk about virtual presence. Well, there's virtual presence in theory, but there's something about the global maritime power and the presence of those ships, either offshore or just doing a port visit, that really is the calling card of a nation. And I think we've seen that recently in the last decade, is China has started to do similar operations where it never had before. And but you know, getting back to the 1980s.
Well, let me follow up on
that
for just a minute, because that's an interesting point. The battleship in particular, even if you argue, and I think it's probably true, that it's an inefficient and archaic platform for the deployment of firepower overseas, but boy, when that thing comes into port, people pay attention. It is something you cannot overlook. It makes a grand statement, even if it never fires a shot. So that is true.
Absolutely. And even though it's great to do med cruises and do your shore tours and your presence ops, Reagan knew that the Navy actually was made to do other things besides making a statement as well. And Reagan was willing to use the Navy and things besides presence. What were some of those circumstances that led to the more active deployment of U.S. Navy assets during his tenure?
Well, there were a number of them, actually. The 1980s were a kind of there's a series of milestones through the 80s where the U.S. Navy was deployed overseas, and not just to make a statement, but to actually act. And to go chronologically through the three or four most prominent of those, in 1983, there was a lot of concern in the Pentagon and in the State Department about the small, tiny island of Grenada, which was building an airfield, an oversized airfield. The argument was, well, it's for tourists to come in, but it was large enough and even larger than it needed to be for that particular purpose. And when Grenada made an agreement with the Soviet Union that they could stage reconnaissance planes off that airfield, and a leftist revolutionary government took over and aligned itself with Cuba, that set off all kinds of alarm bells, and decisions were made in the Pentagon that this put American lives in jeopardy. Now, this is a bit of a rationalization here. Let's be honest about it. There were American citizens at the medical school at St. George in Grenada, which is still there and still educates American citizens to be doctors in the United States. And that was true enough. Their lives may or may not have been in danger, but I think the political circumstances, and particularly the construction of that military-capable airfield, the justification of going into Grenada to protect American lives was certainly part of the answer, but part of it, too, was geopolitics. In any case, the United States mounted what was called Operation Urgent Fury to land special forces teams in Grenada. It led to an amphibious operation, both vertically from the air and amphibiously from the sea, and active combat on the ground, including combat with Cuban troops. So here's a very hot spot in what had been a rather cold war since 1953 that demonstrated the willingness of the Reagan administration to use force, not just to protect American lives, certainly that, but also for geopolitical concerns. And just a few years after that, a long way, 6,000 miles away in the Mediterranean, there was concern in 1986 about Muammar Gaddafi. Now, he'd been a thorn in the side of the United States for years, of course. I mean, the hijackings that were pretty clearly encouraged, if not in fact sponsored by his government. He had claimed the Gulf of Sidra, that sort of indentation on the southern rim of the Mediterranean Sea. He had claimed that as internal waters to Libya, the way that we would claim, for example, the Chesapeake Bay. Nobody else took this claim seriously, and occasionally American planes would overfly the Gulf of Sidra, sort of demonstrate that it still is international airspace. And in 1986, some of Gaddafi's planes fired on American airplanes. Well, that led to the decision to launch retaliation bombings from both fleet forces, that is the six fleet carriers in the Mediterranean, and from land-based planes staged out of Britain. So here's another example of using both naval and air forces to make a statement, to respond. Proportional response was the key phrase popular at the time, I recall, but in any case, to respond. And then the third, and by far the biggest, is Operation Earnest Will, which led into Operation Praying Mantis. And I want to make this point. Praying Mantis in 1988, few people, I think, appreciate this. Praying Mantis was the largest surface naval engagement in the world since Leyte Gulf in World War II. What happened is that the Revolutionary Guard out of Iran, which is only indifferently controlled by the Iranian government, I mean, they're kind of on and off the reservation whenever they feel like it, they had gone out and sown mines in the shipping channels, and U.S. Navy warships were, in fact, escorting tankers up and down the length of the Persian Gulf to keep them out of harm's way from the Iran-Iraq War, which has been going on for almost a decade now. And the Samuel B. Roberts, the USS Samuel B. Roberts, hit one of those mines, was badly damaged, nearly sunk, and Reagan ordered, here we go with the phrase again, a proportional response against Iranian assets. And a study team looked it over, decided what would be proportional, and they decided they would attack several of what were known as gas and oil separation platforms, GOSPs, to use the acronym, out in the middle of the Persian Gulf, Iranian-owned, Iranian-controlled, with Iranian military forces on board, and that this would demonstrate our unhappiness with the planning of the mines and hold Iran responsible. Well, the Iranian Navy came out in response to that and challenged those surface action groups that were attacking the GOSPs, and that led to a surface ship versus surface ship confrontation, both sides firing missiles, both sides firing American-made missiles, by the way, in the first surface missile warfare engagement in world history, and as I mentioned, the largest naval action since Leyte Gulf. And at the end of it, two Iranian warships were sunk, and a third was in sinking condition and allowed to limp back into port. So there were, here's three among couple other smaller events where Reagan demonstrated he was perfectly willing to use military force to make a statement, to buoy his international diplomacy, and to take advantage of that Navy that he'd built up.
And finally, to wind up the decade, I think one of the interesting spots, and different people draw the line different, where was the high water mark of the Soviet Union, but definitely in the beginning, first half of the Soviet Union, in the middle of the first half of the 80s, in the middle of the decade, people never saw what we saw at the end of the very end of the decade, and the beginning of the next, which was the collapse of the Soviet Union. And looking at it in hindsight, that really was one of the big historical events that started to build up steam in the second half of the decade. Well, even though there were indications that especially in 88, 89, 90, that this might be coming along. But eventually the Soviet Empire's power just rapidly necked down. How did that collapse towards the end of the decade of the Soviet Union change U.S. Navy planning and policy as it looked towards the 1990s?
Well, first of all, you're absolutely right about the shock of the collapse of the Soviet Union. It seemed almost unbelievable. There were actually people who thought, wait, this is a ruse. They're only pretending to collapse. It's a gambit of some kind. It just seemed so unlikely. Now, looking back on it, we can see, as you suggested, that there were some straws in the wind. But it's interesting that I think even the Pentagon intelligence groups were making plans based on the assumption that the Soviet Union would continue with similar policies into the next decade. They had already written briefing reports based on that, and yet within a matter of 30 to 60 days, the Soviet Union no longer even existed. So it was absolutely shocking. And of course, combined with that is the problem that force structure planning is a long lead-in. You can't simply say, all right, next year, instead of carriers, we're going to have submarines. It doesn't work like that. These plans were made years, and in some cases, decades before, planning long-term what the force structure would look like. So when the Soviet Union collapsed, and now that we see the Cold War was ended, although now there is a new rivalry between the United States and Russia, and we'll see how that goes, but clearly a force constructed for an open-ended Cold War confrontation with the Soviet Union might or might not be the appropriate force to have in a post-Cold War world. So there's a long delay. It's not that we can throw a switch and say we're changing our force structure. You can see this throughout American history. We talked earlier about battleships. Battleships were probably out of date as the dominant naval force by 1930. But nobody in 1930 was aware of that. And in 1940, Americans and others were still making plans based on the assumption that the battleship was going to be the heart of the fleet, and probably would have taken longer but for the events of World War II, which demonstrated that the carrier had supplanted the battleship as the queen of the sea. And the fleet, therefore, that existed in 1989, at the end of the decade, when the Berlin Wall came down, built for the Cold War, may not have been the ideal fleet for the post-Cold War era. So it changed long-term planning, but changed little in terms of the structure of the Navy right away. Now, the immediate response was a big sigh of relief, of course. I mean, a generation had grown up scrambling under the desks in elementary school in case a nuclear bomb fell on their school. Obviously, the desk would protect them from that bomb. So the idea that we lived in a nuclear world that could be incinerated at any given time, that was a relief to see that ease away. And the other belief was that somehow this would all save us money. I mean, clearly, if the Cold War is now over, we can now spend less. And indeed, DOD and the administration, by then the George H.W. Bush administration, forecast a 14% reduction in defense spending. Much of that, by the way, in the Army and Air Force. The Navy was going to be cut less than either of the other two. The Navy down only by 7%, but down nonetheless. 54 more ships were retired, including, as I mentioned earlier, the last of the battleships. And by 1991, at the end of the decade, the Navy's back down to about 450 ships. So there was a belief that this peace dividend, as it was called, would somehow redound to our spending less money. What it really meant, of course, was spending probably the same amounts of money, but perhaps on different things. But that, as I mentioned, takes a long time to work out, and one would argue it's still being worked out.
And Craig, that brings us to the end of the 1980s, and I look forward to joining you again for the post-Cold War era in the 1990s.
Terrific. Thanks, Al.
Claude, with the 1980s, we find, at least especially for our generation, what we would consider the beginning of the modern era. And with the 1980s, we have a new president, we have a new attitude, a new feeling in the country, and a new view, not just towards the role of the military as we've gotten through the post-Vietnam era, or begin the transition out of the post-Vietnam era, but there's also a new view, and a new appreciation of sea power and where that needs to be in the 1980s to support our national requirements. What do we see in the writing of the period that, that maybe captures this change in the 1980s on people's view?
I think of the 1980s in proceedings and other media within the Naval Institute can be summed up in three words: strategy, strategy, strategy. When you look at the body of work in proceedings, you see article after article of individuals talking about strategic issues. In the 1982 prize essay by Lieutenant Paul Johnson, who was a classmate of Admiral James Stavridis, and I believe they may have been roommates as well, writes about Tomahawk, the implications of a strategic tactical mix. If you look at an article in 1983 on Grenada, by Timothy Ashby, he's looking at a geostrategic look at why the U.S. invaded Grenada in October 1983. In 1984, you have Secretary of the Navy John Layman discussing the nine principles for the future of American maritime power. In 1984, the Honorable Mention Prize was Naval Strategy and National Ocean Policy by then Lieutenant Commander James Stavridis. And as you know, many listeners will know, Admiral Stavridis, currently retired and head of Tufts, Fletcher School of Diplomacy, but Admiral Stavridis has been the only individual to have published in proceedings at every rank from midshipman through four-star admiral. He was UCOM, of course. So you see this new generation thinking about naval strategy and their future. You hear from Cullen Gray, who in 1986 discusses the maritime strategy and takes on critics of the strategy, saying that the U.S. and allied navies are essential to countering the Soviet threat. In 87, looking beyond the maritime strategy by Admiral Carlisle Trost, who was then the CNO, he's describing that the United States is a world power and that maritime strategy is part of our national strategy to exactly the same extent that sea power is part of national security. So I think that is what is key to understanding the 1980s, and I think that goes hand in hand with what the Reagan administration did with regard to sea power, with what John Layman did as Secretary of the Navy. Certainly one of the most influential, in my opinion, secretaries of the Navy in American history, particularly at this pivotal time when you had the Soviet threat. And this was the day that was made for naval strategy and for these individuals to rise to the occasion to discuss how do we deal with the Soviets. This was the big thinking that was happening. So,
what's also interesting about the 1980s, as we talked about in the 1970s, you had this real low point. Almost a bookend to the military's experience in the 1970s in the deserts of Iran with the failed rescue attempt for the hostages. And we also saw in the 1980s two events that one almost describes the Cold War in a small scale and as things nobody knew at the time, but as you're kind of in the last few acts of the Cold War. And another one that would give us hints of the new world that we are definitely still in right now. And two of those events, though relatively small in impact from a military point of view, still resonate today. And with the Soviets' expansion into Central America and the Caribbean, we had, of course, the American response and invasion of Grenada. And there was also our multinational involvement in Beirut that ended up with the attack on the Marine barracks as well. Do we see any writings about the issues from those smaller exchanges in the Cold War and the big attack by Islamic suicide bomber on the Marine barracks that help inform even today some of our discussions?
Interestingly enough, you don't see many pieces about that subject. I mentioned earlier the article about Grenada as a Soviet stepping stone, but really that's the primary one you see. You still see vestiges of the prior decade. There's a 1985 retrospective on Vietnam by Richard Armitage, who was at that point an Assistant Secretary of Defense. He was a Navy veteran, served during the Vietnam War, and actually had some very interesting missions during the Vietnam War, especially toward the end, in extracting people from South Vietnam. But you really don't see that. What you are seeing is the big picture, and I think in some ways it's very similar to today. Our focus is generally with a potential peer competitor. You see a lot of articles today on China, for example. You don't see a lot of articles on irregular challenges. You don't see a lot of these small wars articles, if you will. And I think, you know, there, when you don't see those small issues, you don't know what's ahead. But by the same token, there were so many articles on the Soviet Union and how powerful it was and how we had to deal with it. There are actually no articles suggesting that the Soviet Union would fall by the early 1990s and that they would not be a threat as a Soviet Union. And it would take another decade or two for Russia to reemerge as a world power under Vladimir Putin. So I think that's the interesting case study there.
You know, that brings up an interesting point, because I know in our discussions on previous decades, there were a few events. We talked about how the decade before a major event, there was a lot of discussions and preparations and looking forward, you know, specifically the 1930s, things that really applied to the next big national defense challenge. And we've also seen in more recent history that the topics that people are writing about, the topics that people are discussing during a certain time period, when you look at hindsight, totally miss what's actually coming down the road. I think the 80s, as you describe, were a good example. You look at the huge challenge that we've had adjusting to smaller wards, counterinsurgency, counterinsurgency with special forces, not a big topic of discussion looking into the future. And there was, and I think I have a great copy in acetate in my library that I received as a midshipman of the 1986 maritime strategy that in many ways is almost the star on top of the tree of these big discussions of the 1980s. And when you look through that in hindsight, it looks almost like an addendum to a board game built off a Tom Clancy novel, that many of those things that were brought up and all the money and the investment and the intellectual effort never actually addressed larger issues. Are there other decades similar to the 1980s where we saw a similar disconnect? And is this a pattern that, as a historian, when you look at it, repeats itself, or is this something that just seems to be a rut that was stuck in?
I may be wrong on this, and I'd be the first to admit it, but I believe it's entirely unique. If you look at every other decade, you and I discussed earlier the 1930s, there were articles about how to deal with Germany or Japan and its growth in the Pacific region. Right after 1900, after the turn of the century, we saw articles about growing Germany. We saw these. Some people saw these things coming, but I think the maritime strategy was simply so dominant with regard to the Soviet Union that it was tough to see anything else. But I think it's understandable, given the context of the world we lived in the 1980s. That was the threat. When you look at, I mean, who predicted that? You know, you and I are of the same age. Who would have predicted that Germany would be reunited in, say, 1985, 86, or 87, and what impact a unified Germany would have today. Look who the large powers are in the European theater.
You would have been laughed off a panel, and your stuff would never have been published if somebody in 1987, wrote what was going to happen to Germany, and much less the Warsaw Pact.
Absolutely. So that's why I think it would be a mistake to criticize the 1980s for not necessarily having articles that discuss these other issues, because that was the game. That was the threat. And everybody who lived through the 1980s was wondering, when is that attack going to happen? I would say with regard to the 1980s, I mentioned earlier that it was a golden era for the Naval Institute. I don't mean to diminish any other era in which it existed, particularly the 1870s when it was created. I mean to say it broadened its ability to reach out to the public. And I'll give you a few examples. First, the 1980s was the decade in which they had conferences. They started establishing conferences across the United States to have a dialogue, to put these experts on panels across and to talk to other experts, to talk to neophytes, to talk to the general public. This was the decade that Naval Institute Press published their first major fiction book, The Hunt for Red October. And tell me that didn't have an impact. How many people in the United States would have known what an LA-class submarine was before having read The Hunt for Red October? So, pardon me, even though that was a fiction book, a fiction can be very important as a medium to get ideas across to a general public, a broader public, than would normally read, say, an article in Proceedings or any other professional journal. So that was important. It is likewise also important that Naval History Magazine is established during the 1980s. So now you have a medium to reach back right to the very beginning of U.S. naval history. And that is an incredible magazine that they've been putting out now for nearly 30 years. So now you have this organizational, this very diverse organizational structure of not only Naval Institute Proceedings as the initial the founders back in 1873 envisioned. Now you have people reaching out to historians. Now you have people reaching out to conference attendees regarding, including industry, a very important part of the dialogue. Now you have people reading fiction. And I add not only Hunt for October, but you should also add Stephen Kuntz's Flight of the Intruder. So it wasn't only about submarine warfare or later, but now you had naval air power involved as well. So that was very important. The last point I would make on the 1980s is this, are the people who are writing. In July of 1981, for example, there's an article called Soviet Nuclear Submarines by Norman Polmar. Norman Polmar has been writing for Proceedings, I think, if I recall, since he was 15 or 16 years old when he wrote his first article, and I believe Admiral Hyman Rickover was one of his first interviewees. So Norman Polmar has been writing for Proceedings for about 50 years. He has a wonderful institutional knowledge, but he also brought this other piece to the table of understanding Soviet and other naval capabilities. You have individuals like I mentioned Richard Armitage, who was at that point Assistant Secretary of Defense and goes on to serve during the Bush administration. You have people like Colin Gray, who wrote about naval strategy for many, many years. You have people like the Winnefelds, and I mention the Winnefelds for a specific reason. Rear Admiral James Winnefeld Sr. was a Naval Academy class of 1951, and regret to say that he just recently passed away this past week. Somebody who really embodied an officer and a gentleman and wrote for Proceedings quite frequently and is featured in the 1970s module we have of the exhibit on warrior writers at the United States Naval Academy Museum through 31 January of 2016. But he writes an article in September of 1981 on the quality of the officer corps. He writes other articles throughout that decade as well, such as The Missing Lincoln Fighter Readiness. this is where his son comes in. His son, Lieutenant Commander James Winnefeld Jr., writes the article on a missing link in fighter readiness. James Winnefeld Jr. becomes vice chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff and only retired earlier this year. And he will go on to write another article in 89 on winning the outer air battle, on how we needed to rethink the way we fight our planes from carriers, be forward in the air and attack first. So you have these individuals. Seth Cropsey's another one. Seth Cropsey, who's now one of the leading figures in the think tanks, he's at the Hudson Institute for Sea Power, writes an article in 1985, One Officer at the Top, about the Joint Chiefs of Staff being reorganized. So you have this new crop of individuals in the 1980s. They are the ones continuing to influence the debate today. Stavridis, Winnefeld, Cropsey, Gray, Polmar, Norman Friedman, all of these individuals. So why is it a golden era? It's a rejuvenation of Naval Institute. It's a renewal of naval thought in terms of strategy and how we need to deal today. And I think we'll probably talk about that in the next episode.
Sure. Well, and let's touch on, we've hit the writers and thinkers pretty big. When they visit the exhibit at the U.S. Naval Academy Museum, what represents the 1980s for them?
We actually have a really nice piece of the 1980s. We have, I mentioned Admiral James Winnefeld Jr. He was kind enough to loan to us his name tag when he served as the aide to the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff. At the time, it was Colin Powell. He also provided us with a painting of his call sign. His call sign is JAWS. Now, we didn't realize it before, but it actually stood for just Admiral Winnefeld's son. We have his squadron tags. So we were very fortunate to have Admiral Winnefeld included in this. The Ripley family, Colonel John Ripley, United States Marine Corps, certainly one of the most famous, noted, and respected Marine officers in United States Marine Corps history. The family was very kind to loan to us for the duration of this exhibit several important pieces. His K-bar from Vietnam when he was a captain. We have an AK-47 that he took in Vietnam, and along with the bullet that nearly killed him. We have a letter that was it's a very funny letter that we've had framed that is from his company, somebody in his company, and it's, as you know, Colonel Ripley, when he was Captain Ripley, there's a very famous story of Ripley at the bridge, at the Dong Ha Bridge, where, you know, hand over hand for several hours, he's loading this thing up with explosives in order to blow the bridge up. And he does. He's successful. Afterward, some officers sent him a letter, and it's signed something like Gwyn McMuffin or something. Somebody from North Vietnam who says, you have destroyed our, we recently acquired real estate. You destroyed that piece of property. We therefore require remittance in the payment of so much money. It's a really wonderful, very funny letter in light of the seriousness and the courage and the commitment of that specific mission. So I think those are some of the key items we have. And the last thing I will mention, we have another letter on loan to us from Lieutenant Commander Paul Johnson. I mentioned he was a classmate of Admiral Jim Stavridis, and Paul Johnson had written for Proceedings. We have a letter from him from Admiral Stansfield Turner, another Naval Academy graduate. And Stansfield Turner, as a leading figure in the 1980s, sends this young lieutenant commander a letter, and it's about a 3 or 4 page letter encouraging him to write, but he's also critiquing it. It's taking a very honest look. So this is amazing. You have a very senior flag officer he had never met before saying, I read your article in Proceedings. Here are my comments on it. That is what we need. And Admiral Stavridis has mentioned this in recent years. I think it was in a blog post or a comment that it is very important to have these junior officers write. It is equally important to have that senior flag officer who encourages them to do so in a very responsible manner, to think about these issues And I think those are the lessons that we have from the 1980s.
Absolutely. And with that, we will wind up the decade. And I look forward, Claude, to hitting the 1990s and the beginning of the post-Cold War era.
As do I. Thank you.